Exercise of structures.
Listen and complete the sentences in questions 1 to 5 with the information you've heard. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the questions.
Passage 1. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Brown. For the next 11 weeks, I will be your lab instructor. The lab experiments you will be having are designed to complete your work in Dr. Clapham's inorganic chemistry course. Today's experiment is purposely a short one. It will help you become familiar with the lab setup and equipment. As your lab instructor, it is my duty to assist you in setting up your experiments and understanding your results. I will also grade your lab notebooks, but I have an even more basic responsibility, your physical safety. I will insist on proper precautions, such as wearing protective goggles at all times. I also expect you to use common sense. Don't wear long scarves that might catch fire. Don't smoke. Don't taste unknown substances. Let me reinforce this point with a story. Isaac Newton, perhaps the greatest scientist of all ages, lived in a period when the toxic effects of chemicals were less understood than today. He routinely sniffed fumes, tasted the chemicals, and used open containers for heating substances. In the early 1690s, he suffered through a period of insomnia, depression, and mental instability. Noted biographers linked the situation to problems in his personal life. Researchers now think it was a consequence of his lab procedures. They found abnormally high concentrations of lead, mercury, and other heavy metals in preserved specimens of his hair. Consequently, we must learn from the past and put safety first.
Passage 2. I want to thank Professor James for letting me have a few minutes of class time to tell you about our field trip tomorrow. We will be leaving by bus at 8 in the morning and returning at about 5. Please bring your lunch. As you know, this trip is a requirement of the course. You are all expected to participate and then to write up a report in your lab notebooks. I put together a handbook to orient you. Please pick it up after class and read it tonight. In it, I discuss the members of the pine family found here in the Northeast. As you have learned, the pine family is composed of pines, larches, spruces, hemlocks, Douglas firs, and true firs. With the exception of Douglas firs, which grow only in the western part of the country, we'll be looking at examples of them all. The sketches in the handout should help you distinguish the various types of trees. As your leader tomorrow, I'll try to make the experience a rewarding one. A field trip is a little like a bank. What you get out of it depends on what you put into it. Passage 3. The main types of agricultural activities in Australia are wheat growing and cattle and sheep rearing. This is concentrated mostly in the coastal areas, where land is not so dry. As a result of the cattle and sheep farms, cottage industries have arisen, and they deal with cowhides, sheepskins, and so on. The cottage industry is becoming of major importance to Australia, as it is going to develop its tourist industry. An increasing important resource in Australia is the beaches. These are being developed for recreational purposes, exploiting the surf, sand, abundant marine life, and favourable temperature of conditions of the area. This area is called Australia's Gold Coast. Australia's government is also making full use of its interior, and one of Australia's fastest growing towns is Alice Springs, the home of the fascinating rock formations, particularly Ayers Rock. Although agriculture is so rich in Australia, 30% of the population lives in the urban areas. The main commercial areas of Australia are its major cities, which are situated along the coast: Perth, Darwin, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide. These cities are more service-orientated and provide the populace with a high standard of facilities and infrastructure.
Passage 4. The United Nations General Assembly adopted a formal decision in November 1995, aiming to promote greater equality among the 6 official UN languages and to halt the growing dominance of English at the world's headquarters. In addition to English, the official languages of the 185 Nation Assembly and the 15 Member Security Council are Arabic, Chinese, French, Russian, and Spanish. The working languages of the UN Secretariat are English and French. The decision's 75 sponsors, led by France, are upset that documents are often initially available only in English, and diplomats have to negotiate on text before they are available in their preferred language, or with an interpreter. The decision asks Secretary General Ghali to ensure that the UN decisions on the use of various languages are strictly carried out, and to ensure that the use of another of the 6 official languages are encouraged and taken into account, especially when staff are considered.
Passage 5. John Maynard Keynes was the most influential British economist of the 20th century. He was born in Cambridge, England, in 1883. Keynes won a scholarship to Eton. He entered King's College, Cambridge, also on a scholarship, and took his degree in mathematics in 1905. After obtaining his degree, he studied economics for a year, with the help of Alfred Marshall and A.C. Pigou. At the request of Alfred Marshall, he began to teach economics at Cambridge. Keynes served as an economic advisor to the British Treasury during the First World War. Then, in the early 1920s, Keynes acted as a consultant to investment firms. He also founded 3 investment trusts. His major economic works are Treatise on Money, 1930, and The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, 1936. In March 1946, he went to the U.S. to attend a conference at Savannah, Galveston. After the conference, he had a very severe heart attack on the train. He died at his home on April 21st, 1946.
Passage 6. British universities can be divided roughly into three main groups. The old universities. These are the universities founding before the year 1600. Oxford and Cambridge are the oldest of the British universities, dating from 1249 and 1284. Since that time, they have continued to grow. In the 14th and the 15th centuries, four universities were founded in Scotland: St. Andrews, 1411, Glasgow, 1450, Aberdeen, 1494, and Edinburgh, 1583. The red brick universities. These include all the provincial universities of the period 1850 to 1930. As well as London University. The term red brick is not used much today, but is useful for defining this group of universities, which were all built in the favourite building material of the period, red brick. The new universities, these are the universities founded since the Second World War, each has its own independent approach to teaching, and many students are now choosing the new universities because of their more modern approach, in preference to Oxford, Cambridge, or the red brick universities. Altogether, there are now 44 universities in the United Kingdom, 33 in England, 8 in Scotland, 2 in Northern Ireland, and 1 Federation of Seven Colleges in Wales.
Passage 7. Some cities grow very large because of two important reasons. Firstly, there may be important natural resources like wood, gas, oil, rivers or harbours near or in the city. Natural resources like wood or oil can be brought to the city and made into products to sell. Other resources like rivers or harbours help to send the city's products to other places to be sold. Second, the city may be located in a place where roads and rivers come together. This makes these cities good places to buy and sell goods. Houston is a big city that grew large because it has two important natural resources. They are oil and a good harbor. The oil can be brought to Houston, made into different products, and shipped out of the harbour to other parts of the world. Chicago is a city that grew very large because of its location at a place where roads, railways, and airways meet. In Chicago, goods can be brought together from all over the country and bought and sold. Then the goods can be loaded into trucks, trains, or planes and sent to wherever they are needed. Because of Chicago's location, many people live and work there.
Passage 8. The 1992 Summer Olympics will be here sooner than you might realize, and already work has begun in Barcelona, Spain, to prepare the Olympic facilities. It may still be a little early to talk about who will and who will not do well, but I think it is safe to say that once again the best teams will come from Russia, Germany, China, in the United States. To my way of thinking, however, winning is not the most aspect of the Olympics. The Olympics should not be a contest to see which country has the best athletes. After all, the true spirit of the Olympics is the spirit of brotherhood, not the spirit of nationalism. There is no need for politics. In my opinion, there should only be one flag at the Olympics flag. And there's no need to play the national anthem of the country whose representative has won a particular event. Another suggestion I want to make is that the distinction between amateur and professional be eliminated from the Olympic Games. Everyone knows that some countries, notably Germany and Russia, pay their athletes. But, rather than arguing about who is and who isn't an amateur, why not allow all athletes to enter? Winning is still an important consideration, but perhaps someday the biggest winner at the Olympics will be the competitor who has not the medals, but the most friends.
Passage 9. The Amazon has been called the greatest river in the world. Only the Nile River in Egypt may be longer, but no one is sure, because the Amazon has yet fully to be explored. We do know that it begins in the Andes Mountains of Peru and flows almost 6,400 kilometers across Brazil down to the Atlantic Ocean. The Amazon River itself may be large, but it also has over 1,000 tributary rivers and smaller streams. 17 of the tributaries are over 1,600 kilometers long, and this is longer than many of the greatest rivers in the world, including Europe's Rhine River. So complex is the river that many European maps still refer to it as the Amazons. The Spanish soldier Francisco de Orellana was the first European to explore the Amazon between 1541 and 1542. Since then, there have been many attempts to explore the river. Many books have been written about the Amazon. A former US president, Theodore Roosevelt, helped lead an expedition to explore the river between 1913 and 1914. That expedition gathered information and collected history specimens. One thing seems certain. No matter how many explorations of the Amazon there are, it will be a long time before the greatest river in the world reveals its secrets.
Passage 10. Sigmund Freud developed a system of psychoanalysis while he was studying cases of mental illness. By examining details of the patient's life, he found that the illness could often be traced back to some definite problem or conflict within the person concerned. In 1914, he published a book named The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, This book goes a long way towards explaining some of the strange behavior of normal, sane people. A glance at Freud's chapter heading will indicate some of the aspects of behavior covered by the book. Forgetting of proper names, forgetting of foreign words, childhood and concerning memories, mistakes in the reading and writing. Broadly, Freud demonstrates that there are good reasons for many of the slips and errors that we make. We forget a name because unconsciously we do not wish to remember that name. We repress a childhood memory because that memory is painful to us. A slip of the tongue or of the pen betrays a wish of which we are ashamed. In these days when every day would be a doctor or writer has access to Freud's accounts of his research, it is worth pausing and remembering the remarkable scope and originality of his ideas.